I'm
Good
muting myself.
afternoon. Yes, see, she talks when I start. This is what she does. Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of our unnamed podcast. Yet we're trying, maybe Martin can help us. We're trying to collaborate together and come up with a name for this podcast show where we bring fruition and those that need to be held accountable to the forefront. So everybody knows I'm Dr. Victoria Curie. I have Whitney Lee with me, who is amazing, and I adore her with the Impostrix Syndrome podcast. And then I have somebody who started with me way back in the day, Martin. I'm so excited he's back. I haven't had him on a show in forever. He has the most amazing story. I was telling Whitney before we started recording about the triumph and inspiration that Martin brings just talking to him. Just knowing him, knowing what he's been through, and it is such an honor to have both of you, even though Whitney hosts with me, but it's always an honor. So I want to thank Martin for being here, and I'm gonna let Whitney poke and prod you a little bit to get a little bit of your backstory.
Yeah, I was
Sure.
laughing because it was like, even though Whitney's just a normal person.
I never say that. I never say that.
Thank you, Martin, for joining us. So I, like Victoria said, am just getting like caught up to speed as to who you are and what you're about. I wonder if you can share with us just the cliff notes of who are you? What drives you?
Who am I? I think I'm still in the middle of figuring that out. It's been quite the journey. So I am currently, I guess, we start with our job titles, even though we're so much more than that. But I am the director of cultural engagement at Lions for Life, which is an organization based out of Portland, Oregon, that is dedicated to reducing stigma around mental health and getting people connected with those resources as well as substance use resources. So in a nutshell, we take all the crisis lines for 988 in the state of Oregon, as well as we have a military help line for struggling veterans. We have a youth line for youth who can get connected with peers. We have a senior loneliness line. We have a racial equity support line. So essentially we have a hodgepodge, if you will, of crisis lines to try to meet the needs of the community as diverse as they are. And so I lead a small team into the community to specifically talk to Black, Brown, and Indigenous people about mental health and how it looks different for us, quite frankly, and how the resources and support should likewise be different and feel different. So we do that. And in my private life, I speak publicly at high schools, colleges, conferences about DUI prevention because there's a whole story there around a DUI that cost me 17 and a half years in prison. So we can talk about that more if you guys want to delve into that.
Martin, I was telling Whitney before you joined us that there was that pivotal moment when this happened that really changed you. And I was telling her just what an amazing person you are during the entire thing. I mean, there's a difference between somebody who goes out there with premeditation and malicious and go out there and hurt somebody or take a life. But you were so concerned about the other people involved, and you were more concerned about them than you. And the way that you handled the entire situation and the incarceration, what was that pivotal moment? I know you've shared it with me, but I really want Whitney to hear it too, where you, it was just that moment for you where it was just so real.
Sure. So just to kind of give a little context, so it was a fatal crash that I caused on New Year's Eve of 2003 in Portland. I was heavy into my addiction at that point. At 24 years old, I've been drinking since I was 14, dealing with a lot of internal struggles about my identity and self-concept and just, the whole thing. And so it culminated with a fatal crash that claimed the lives of two people and severely injured a third person. This was in Portland, Oregon. And it was like 3 or 4 days later, I'm in my cell, minding my own business. And someone had slid the Oregonian newspaper underneath my cell door, and I couldn't understand why I didn't ask anybody to see a paper. So I pick it up, I begin to thumb through this paper, and I see my picture on the front page of one of the sections. And I began to read each paragraph that morning, and the lives of my victims began to unfold in these paragraphs. And what I learned that morning was that these were two people who were in recovery. They had like 16 and 17 years in recovery, respectively. They were advocates in the community to help people get connected to substance use resources. They would volunteer to watch women's children so that these ladies could attend AA and NA meetings, right? They were heavily, heavily involved in the recovery community in Portland. And the night that this happened, they were returning home from a clean and sober New Year's Eve party at the Oregon Convention Center when they were struck and killed by a drunk driver. And so the columnist had you know, he talked about he called it a palpable irony that these people who had devoted their lives to help people get clean and sober would have their lives cut short by a drunk driver. And then he said something at the end of the article, changed my life forever. He said, perhaps the person they will have ended up helping the most is the man who's charged with killing them. And it was such a heavy, profound statement, right? I'm 24 years old, and I know based on the mandatory minimum sentencing laws in Oregon, I know that I'm going to prison for about 20 years, day for day. We can't earn a single day off for good behavior, for working a job, getting an education. None of that matters. So I know I'm going to be a middle-aged man by the time I get out. So it was hard to fully wrap my head around what he had just said and how this situation is possibly going to help me. But I also knew what he said could not be ignored, right? I had to figure out what those words were supposed to mean for my life. And so I remember for the next 5 or 6 months, I mean, I prayed about it. Like that's all I knew how to do at that point. I literally meditated on that phrase, hearing it multiple times a day in my head. And, you know, and then it finally came to me that, you know, the only way this tragedy will not be in vain is if I carry on these people's legacies. If I literally make that my life's mission, my life's purpose, my life's leading cause, and just throw myself into this work. And I didn't know how that would manifest. I didn't know what opportunities would avail themselves throughout my incarceration. I didn't even know how long I was going to be in prison. I knew it was going to be a long time. I didn't know how long. I just knew I was committed in that moment. And so I kind of trusted, if you will. You know, I trusted God. I mean, you know, people have their ways of viewing that, but I trusted God to kind of guide my steps and lead and lead the way. And that's what happened. You know, there's a whole story of when I got into prison and what I did for things to unfold for me, or for, you know, for God to kind of allow things to unfold for me the way they did. But that was the pivotal moment, reading that newspaper in that cell a few days into this tragedy, and really starting to get some clarity around what was supposed to transpire over the next 17 and a half years.
Wow. That means a lot. So I'm somebody who's in long-term recovery. And so I've known people, of course, who have died behind our addiction. I also know people who have been killed, you know, behind someone else's addiction. And I think it's like tragically poetic, is I think, you know, a bit about what that reporter was talking about. And as Victoria and I have been having these conversations with others, you know, the theme that is emerging is this reality of where we as humans run into a roadblock, how we are able to lift ourselves back up and create change, meaningful change, through the perspective that we now have because of our experiences. So in our last conversation with Marla Thomas, it was about dealing with mental illness in her family and dealing with all of the barriers that were in place to be able to find good mental health care and safe mental health care for her loved ones. And, you know, now she's, her and her husband have started a foundation and are going to be building step down units in California for people who are being released from psychiatric centers to be able to live in. And I hear you talking about this story of, you know, you said you were in the throes of your addiction and having, you know, murdered these people whose lives at this point were dedicated to their sobriety and to helping spread the message to others. And it's just really inspiring to hear stories where people, like, some shit has happened, you know, like, this is not fair type of shit. Not fair, not okay, painful, traumatic. And yet through this, there are lessons that we can take. There are passions that can grow within us to create something else, something, you know, beautiful, something meaningful, something impactful to other people. And so now I'm thinking about, you know, that reporter said, maybe you're the one that's being helped the most by these people. And now I'm thinking about all of the people that you're working with, who you're now helping, because you've now made this tragedy the story to inspire your life's mission. So I wonder if you can talk about, like, what your role is in the recovery community, because I see that you've got your substance abuse counselor certification, and you talked about being, you know, committed to this message and speaking to people about DUI and stuff like that. So what does that look like for you?
Yeah, so when I was inside, I had about 6 or 7 years left, and they had started a DUI victim impact panel within the prison where they would bring in people from the community who had lost loved ones to a DUI driver. And they would sit in a room with about 50 inmates in a circle. And, well, now they call them adults in custody. I guess I should use that terminology as opposed to inmates. So 50 AICs, adults in custody, sitting in a circle. And this person would tell this tragic story of how they had lost a daughter or a son or a husband or a wife to a DUI driver, and the difficulty of going through the trial process and never getting an apology from the person who had done this, right? Just this gut-wrenching process they had gone through. And then we would, one of us on the inside who had perpetrated this crime would tell our story of you know, obviously having full remorse and accountability and contrition and all those things. And it was just such a healing space that we were in with these folks. There were tears, there were hugs, and it was so cathartic to be a part of that. And so I knew when I embarked on that, I knew that once I got out, I was going to speak at DUI victim impact panels and things like that. I had no idea that I would, so a couple years later, still incarcerated, I recorded my story to put on YouTube, just to have my story out there. Maybe it might help one or two people, or 10 or 12. The pandemic happens and everybody's searching for online content for the DUI victim impact panels. And the numbers just skyrocketed on that video. And even today I get messages from people in Georgia, Arkansas, Texas, California. I go to conferences, New York, Pennsylvania, Oregon, everybody, not everybody, but there's always at least one person that comes up to me and says, I show your video at my panel, you know, every month. And like the response that we get is so powerful. And like that, so that tells me I have one intention in mind, which was just to put it out there and just maybe it'll help a few people. Had no idea a pandemic was gonna happen, that people would need online content, that this thing would reach, you know, tens of thousands, if not more, people, right? But that's where my spirituality comes into places. Like, I feel like God knew exactly what, you know, what he was doing with that process. So to ask what I do today, so for the last 2 years, I've been out since June of 21. So it's been about 2.5 years. The first 2+ years, I worked on the drug and alcohol helpline at Lines for Life. And I would take calls. So in Oregon, when you are cited with a small amount of drugs, you don't go to jail anymore. You get a citation. And then the judge tells you to call somebody like me or one of my colleagues to do a screening on the phone with you. And then at the end of that call, we're going to talk to you about resources and getting connected. And then we give you a certificate. You go to court, you get the $100 fine waived, and you go about your business. But that is kind of that first line of defense, if you will, to be able to connect with people who need help, right? And their incentive is to call and get the $100 fine dropped. But our motivation is to get these people connected to treatment where they live. And so I did that for a couple of years. I speak remotely at DUI Victim Impact. I have one tonight, for that matter, with the hospital that treated the one guy who survived my crash almost 20 years ago. They do a DUI Victim Impact panel with first-time DUI offenders every month. I do that twice a month, actually. I speak at alcohol highway safety classes here in Pennsylvania. I speak at high schools. I speak at conferences. I went on the Save a Life tour in New York, where they go to high schools and colleges. They bring these big simulators so kids can get inside, put on virtual reality goggles, and feel what it feels like to drive impaired or to drive while texting. And then I tell my story there. And I speak at conferences. I was just at a law enforcement conference in Harrisburg, and I did one in New York last month. I've done a few of those DUI task enforcement conferences, as well as the Pennsylvania Drug Treatment Court Professionals Conference. And I've done a couple others. And so basically, I speak, depending on the audience, the message is going to vary somewhat, whether you're somebody who's gotten a DUI or you're the person who is treating the person who's gotten a DUI. I try to use my story as a way to impact that work. And then I go to AA, right? I'm a huge proponent of AA. Those are my people. I tell people all the time that, you know, you have family, you have friends, and they're great for support. But if they don't understand addiction and what that looks like and how that manifests, you cannot go to them when you are struggling with cravings, or, you know, your addicted brain wants to try to ramp up and tell you some things that are clearly not true, right? You need to go to your people. You have to be in those rooms with people who understand what that feels like and what that looks like, so that they can give you the support that you need to get through that. So, I mean, there's more there, but I think I've given you a mouthful or an earful.
How were you treated while you were incarcerated? How were you treated by the correctional officers?
So I will say this, for me personally, I mean, of course, you're always feeling dehumanized, right? When you're referred to as a number more often than your name, you are feeling dehumanized, right? Or your cell number, right? I'm 46B. I'm not Martin Lockett, right? Or I'm inmate Lockett, right? You're always reminded that you are different than you know, everybody outside of these walls. And I don't know if that's intentional. I don't know if that's just the nature of being in an institution. I mean, I have my beliefs about the intentionality behind it. But whatever the case, you are made to feel dehumanized. And so, but I will say for me personally, I wasn't, you know, like the officers saw how I conducted myself. They saw I was consistent in the way I did my time. I never got in trouble. I never, you know, joined a gang. You know, I stayed out of the way. I worked as an educational tutor. I did my college courses. Like, they saw who I was. And so they more or less, you know, kind of left me alone. But the guys who were, you know, going a different path, oh, those officers were brutal. I mean, they were absolutely brutal. And I felt sorry for guys, but I also felt helpless, because, like, what am I going to do? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. They have all the authority. They have all the power. But it is just so dehumanizing, just the whole existence of being in a facility. And so I'll tell you, for me, I pushed back against it psychologically for myself. So for instance, so many guys, because they're there for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, they want to normalize that setting. So for instance, instead of saying I'm going to go to canteen, they say I'm going to go to the store. Instead of I'm going to medical, I'm going to the hospital. Right. Instead of I'm going to my cell, I'm going to my house. And I'm like, I'm never going to refer to any of these things as my house, the hospital, the store. I don't want it to feel normal, because it's not normal. Right. And so I refuse to kind of condition myself to making prison feel normal. right? I mean, yeah, you have to comply. You have to kind of lay or understand the lay of the land. But psychologically, like, I rebelled fiercely, you know? And I think it kept me kind of forward thinking. It kept my mind not incarcerated, my mentality free. And so that's pretty much how I got through that 17 and a half years.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, on that point, you mentioned when we started out, changing the terminology from inmate to adult in custody. And that's something that we do in my work as well, is we don't refer to people by saying inmate or saying prisoner or saying the words that the state has given somebody, but instead calling people, you know, individuals who are incarcerated, or incarcerated individual, or incarcerated person, or person that's currently in a jail or prison. Because, you know, my belief, and now I am on really one far side of this debate around prisons and jail psychology and all of that stuff. But like, the purpose of this system is to break you down and to let you know that you are no longer a person. You lost your humanity, your personhood, at the point where you entered those doors, where the gate locked behind you. And so my belief is the calling the person by the number, calling the person by inmates, is all to make you take on the subservient nature of slavery. And, you know, I think it's interesting to hear you talk about normalizing that, the condition of being in prison, because that is something that as an advocate, I hear a lot. I hear that language a lot. I hear I'm going to the store a lot. And in my mind, as somebody that's never been in prison, never been incarcerated, never had to go to, the store, if you will, you know, I'm like, but so are you leaving? Like, what do you mean you're going to the store? And when in reality, you know, what's happening is they're picking stuff off a menu and it's being delivered to their cell. You know, people calling their cell their rooms. And I think as an advocate, it's an interesting and sometimes difficult linguistic line to walk, because I want to value you and your experience and the language that you want to use. Like, who am I to say that this ain't a store? You know, whatever you want to call it, I want to, you know, I don't need to call it commissary. I can call it store if you want to call it store, you know? So I do think that's really an interesting perspective. And one of the people that I worked with for a long time talked about the institutionalization of people who are incarcerated, and how for him, keeping his name was really important, keeping his name intact, responding to his name. And for me, it was really important to call him formally, to call him Mr. Such and Such, instead of even a first name, recognizing that so often people who are in this position are never referred to in a respectful manner, ever. And let me be the only person then this week or this month or this year to call this person in a way that honors them and their dignity. So Victoria, you were going to ask Martin something.
Yeah, I get asked all the time, but I would love to hear it from you, as you know, my husband and I have that law enforcement background as well. And we see things totally different than a lot of officers. There's great officers out there, and there's some really crappy ass officers out there, and I'll be the first to say that. But did you see, and I wanted to hear it from your point of view, did you see how like inmates treated other inmates different? So if you were in there, say, for a DUI, you were treated one way. If you were in there for child molestation, you were treated a different way. If you were a pedophile, obviously, you were treated a different way. Is that something that, as someone who was incarcerated, is that fair to say? I mean, how was the different charges and, you know, the person, how are they treated differently once they were incarcerated?
1,000%, Victoria. There is definitely kind of a stratification, a social stratification system in place, depending on your charges, right? which is, I mean, when you think about it, like to think a guy who committed murder is at the top of that chain, right? But think about that. This guy took a parent from their child, a brother from his mother, and right. I mean, just think about that. Right. And he's celebrated. Right.
Like a cop killer. A cop killer celebrated in jail.
Exactly. But people they don't go that far to look at it. They're just like, oh yeah, he's a tough guy. He took somebody's life. But it's like, but look at the ripple effect of that. Now this person's kids have to grow up without their parent, right? The trauma that family is suffering. So yes, there is, based on what you did, there's a hierarchy. And obviously, if you have anything sex related, whether it's sexual assault against a fully grown adult or touching a kid, like, you are going to have a hard time. They get extorted. Like, you go to a job and you're making $40 to $50 a month, right? And that's a decent job. I was at the top pay, $78 a month. So, I was, living like the Cosby's, if you will. But those guys who make $30 and $40, like, they have to go to the commissary and at least give half of that to the extorters, which were the gang members, right? The gang members run the yard, right? They run the yard. They dictate what group is going to sit at this table outside, what group is going to sit at this table. Like, in the chow hall, it's all segregated. And the child molesters and sexual offenders, like, it's not funny, because I just think human beings across the board should be treated like human beings. But it is tough. Like, it is so tough. Or if you told on somebody who's a gang member, right? Then that whole gang is after you. I've seen guys get transferred from prison to prison to prison because no matter where they went, somebody was after them. So then they have to eventually put them in administrative segregation. So it's like you're in the hole or segregation, even though you didn't do anything wrong, but like, for your own protection, like, we have to keep you safe because we're liable if somebody kills you on the yard. So it is a tough deal. And I'll finish by saying this. There were even some correctional officers, because they obviously can, they can see all the charges of people who are incarcerated. And I promise you, I've seen it. I wouldn't have believed it if I didn't see it myself. And because they have a little, like a little office behind the officer station where they go and have a computer, and they will call some inmates back there and show these inmates, a person's charges. Right. And then now everybody knows this person's charges, and that guy is getting beat up on the yard the next day. Like, an officer was behind that.
And so they turn around and look a blind eye if it's pending.
Right. But they're the ones who conspired the whole thing. Exactly. Exactly. And so it's a bad, bad time for people with those types of charges.
Do you think that they can be reformed? A pedophile can get reformed while incarcerated?
I think if there is the proper treatment, but the thing is, you have to think about why there's a difference of opinions as to whether or not there's any effective treatment for these folks. I know they've had some programs over the years about accountability and empathy building and things like that, to understand the hurt that they cause these victims, right? But imagine trying to have a program like that in prison, because everybody would know, anybody who walked through that door for that program, oh, we know why you're here. So how would you even implement something like that in an institutional setting?
Yeah, so I'm in Georgia. Georgia prisons are exactly what you think they would be. Deadly. Just deadly. Georgia jails, even, are deadly. And one of the things that, to your point of what we would hear about often, was just COs yelling at the top of their lungs, what somebody's charges are, or that somebody's attorney was calling to talk about XYZ, so that everybody, you know, on the floor can hear, you know, this person's business. And I've had people who ask me not to mail them stuff because they're concerned that I'm going to put in my mail something having to do with their charges. And mail isn't secure in jails and prisons. So I wonder, you know, I'm just thinking about your impact that you have, that you're having on people that you're talking to. Do you have any experiences of working with people, sharing your story with people, and then those people coming back and saying, hey, Martin, like, you changed my life. Like, this is the road that I was down, and this is what I'm doing now. And, like, thank you. Do you have any stories like that you can share with us?
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny that, you know, where those stories have existed have been through Instagram. So since I've been out, so there's a page on Instagram, there's a whole recovery community on Instagram, and there's a page on there that is called A Life Recovered. And it's an awesome page where the guy will, he will solicit stories from people to talk about their addiction and now their recovery, whether they have one day in recovery or 10 years or 20 years. And it's always a before and after picture side by side, right? To really give you that snapshot of a life that has been recovered. And so he, when I first shared my story on his page about a year and a few months ago, then he would have people reach out to him and would say, hey, you know, I'm struggling. I'm, you know, in the midst of my addiction or alcoholism. I need some help. So he asked me if it would be okay if he could refer some people to me. And I was like, sure, like this is the work that I'm doing, however that connection needs to be made. So I remember there was one person in particular. It really stood out to me. This person, a young lady, early 20s, highly addicted to opioids, had been doing them for like 10 or 11 years, you know, just emaciated, you know, not working, not going to school, just literally withering away and dying, right? But she wanted help. And so we had a few phone calls. I gave her some local resources, but mainly like she just got comfort in having somebody to talk to. You know what I mean? Just having somebody to talk to if she was having a bad day. So she went to a detox program that I referred her to, got clean off the opioids, connected her with a psychiatrist to be able to give her some medication for her mental health, because that's what was underlying it all. She got a job, and has been working that job now for about 3 months, I want to say. She was homeless. She now has an apartment. And like her whole life. So now we're talking about her, like thinking about her future and going to school and things like that. And, you know, she still has some tough days, but she has not relapsed. She's come close, but she has not relapsed. And I told her, like, even if a relapse did happen, God forbid, but it wouldn't be the end of the world. We would need to assess what was going on in your life that led to that relapse so that we can kind of shore up that, you know, shore that up in a stronger prevention, relapse prevention plan, right? She goes to NA. So it's just a beautiful thing to see. And like to even see pictures of her when she was in her addiction, to now see her, like, it's just so, she's so vibrant and just lively and just like looks happy to be alive. You know what I mean? And so, and I mean, that happened through Instagram. And so, you know, it's just, you reach people where they are and you try to, you know, I think at the end of the day, underlying a lot of our struggles is like just a lack of human connection, like good human support, right? Like you cannot have too many people in your support system. If these are solid people that care about you, just to know that you're not alone going through whatever you're going through, and we all go through stuff, as long as we have that community kind of holding us up and embracing us and, you know, giving us that comfort, you know, that's how we make it through.
Yeah, I think that's right. Recovery and isolation, you know, for me is just white knuckling it. I mean, that's not sobriety for me. And I think, you know, I'm a 12-stepper. That's the method that I use, but I know that there are others out there. And I think, to your point, the value is in community, is in recovering with other people and talking about what our experiences are. Because, you know, for folks that are listening who are maybe struggling with addiction, it's hard. Like, life is hard, it turns out. And you know, a lot of us, when we build these maladaptive ways of coping, I think the expectation is that once we stop using or we stop drinking or we stop doing whatever behavior that we're doing, that life will be easy. And unfortunately, life is just hard. People still die. We still get fired from jobs. We still got attitude problems. We still got kids that hate us, you know, and it's, but when you're recovering in community, then you have other people who can share with you how they made it through. And I think Victoria's a contagious smile and the support that she provides to people who are, you know, recovering from physical abuse, from the trauma, from disability, and living, learning how to live this life with their trauma, I think is so valuable because of the community part. Because, you know, Victoria has experienced it, has been through the things, has been through the legal issues, has been through the family, you know, all of that. And I just think it is, you know, also for folks that are listening, if whatever the situation is that you're experiencing, find someone, you know, who you can talk to about what you're experiencing, because you're not the only one. Like, you're just not. You're not, what do we say in AA? Like, we're not terminally unique. Like, it, you're not that special. Like, we're all going through it. This is actually just life. Unfortunately or fortunately, like, it's actually just life. And you know, there are many of us who survive this. And I love hearing your story, Martin, because you're thriving despite, you know, decisions that you made, despite addiction or alcoholism or whatever it is. And I think that I hope that that gives folks hope.
Well, and I appreciate that. I want to go back to something you said earlier when you were saying that, like, there's always these obstacles or barriers or you know, kind of roadblocks that we hit, and it's like it's a pivotal moment, right? Where it kind of, you know, launches us into this whole, maybe a whole new direction in life, but it's purpose filled and it's very, you know, mission driven. And it's because we went through that tragedy or pain or trauma that kind of you know, led us to do the work that we do. And I think frankly, I don't think we just go through terrible circumstances just because. I feel like there's always an underlying purpose and reason and something to extract from that that is supposed to, you know, I don't know if it's give us an epiphany, but it's we're supposed to be changed by that, right? There's always a purpose and a reason. But now some things we just go through, and this is, we just go through it because we do. But I think a lot of things, especially like the major moments of adversity, I feel like there are invaluable life lessons that are to be extracted from that. And those are supposed to be pivotal points in our lives, where we're supposed to take some guidance and direction from. And you know, so I think it's important to remind people that I always tell them, even when I counsel people one-on-one as well, privately, it's another one of my private ventures. But you know, it's more important, the why. The why is more important than the what, right? What I'm going through, yeah, it sucks and it's terrible, but it's more important for me to figure out the why, right? Because that way, so like, if I had looked at my 17 and a half years in prison as what I'm going through, then it would have been doom and gloom every single day. I would have been, you know, looking at calendars and just like, just getting depressed because like my release date is 2021 and here it is 2004. Like, how does that bring me anything of comfort? So I stayed fixated on the why. And so once I figured out the why and I allowed that to kind of guide my steps, like, then I stayed with my head down and I was mission focused, right? And like, that's when I learned about the origins of my addiction and criminality and start to peel back the layers of my addiction and criminality and kind of got to the origin of where it all started for me and why I felt how I did at 13, 14, 15 years old. That drove me into, you know, doing things I wouldn't normally do, wasn't raised to do. Nobody in my family, you know, was an alcoholic but me. You know, nobody struggled as far as I know with their identity issues as much as I did. And so once I was able to kind of ascertain, you know, why everything went the way that it did for me, then I was able to pour that into other young guys coming into the system, leading them away from the prison gangs and the prison politics and all that nonsense, and kind of just have some real moments with those. That led to me having conversations with young guys on the yard about childhood trauma, about being molested, stuff you don't talk about in prison, like at all, but they felt comfortable with me. They Wow. felt safe with me because they saw the work that I was doing and they saw I was different than a lot of guys there. And this is not to disparage anybody, and people get through prison how they need to, how they feel they need to, right? But I knew going in that I was not going to be doing my time that way. And so I'm grateful for those moments. I'm grateful I still keep in contact with some of those young guys today that I was in prison with 15 years ago. You know what I mean? And so it's, again, you know, none of that was by accident, if you ask me.
Absolutely. I want to thank Whitney for her sweet words. They mean so much to me. They really, really do. But Martin, when you speak, the sincerity is so authentic. It feels, and I know that everybody's going to say, oh my God, Victoria's just a cheesehead, but you're like, you are, it's like, I know she's laughing at me. It's like a verbal hug. It really is, because it's soft and it's genuine and it's full of care. And it literally, when he talks about his compassion, it's like just the sweetest, softest verbal hug that I know so many people, they need. And you offer that. And I've had the honor of knowing him for a couple of years now, and he has stayed who he is. He has not changed at all in any way. And I want him to be on with us more than every couple of years, just saying. But I know you have to go and you have a meeting in a couple of minutes, and I literally threw you into this today. Tell everybody where they can find you and your three books that are out. I've read two of them and they are amazing, and everybody should go out and purchase them, but how everybody can find you.
First of all, thank you so much for saying that, Victoria. You guys are doing awesome work. You have been steadfast in this work and helping people who need it the most, people who suffer from trauma, people who have been down and out, people who have felt that there's nobody out there for them, and you all have reached those folks. So it was an honor to be on with you guys today. I guess the easiest way to, I'm only on one social media platform, which is Instagram, Martin L. Lockett. And then my website is martinlockett.com. And that would be probably the easiest way to reach out via email or, yeah.
And all of his books are on Amazon. He's not mentioning that, but they are really, really great reads. Like I said, everybody should go out and read them. When I got my copies, I couldn't put them down. And I don't have time to read. I work like a crazy person. But they're just, it's really his insight as to how things are really eye-opening. Even for me with the background that I have, it's a lot of things people don't have a clue about and really does need to come to the forefront, because things need to change, definitely need to change. And I want to thank Martin, and I'm going to let Whitney close us out.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I think this is really impactful for me. And I'm sure for others as well. Yeah. I'm at a loss for words, frankly.
That doesn't happen often.
Whatever. Anyways, Victoria and I are going to be doing these types of conversations on a weekly basis for the foreseeable future. We still don't have a name yet, but I think we're themes are emerging, as I said at the outset. And so
if you have an idea of a name, Martin, let us know, because we're trying to figure that out.
Yeah. The more I think about it, Victoria, the Phoenix situation logo, or like a animal that can be our spirit animal, is the Phoenix.
That's what I suggested.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying.
But you know what? You need to be validated. I'm just saying.
So on that note, you can catch Victoria and I on our separate podcasts. My podcast is Impostrix Podcast, Validating Professionals of Color Who Navigate Imposter Syndrome and Racial Toxicity. And Victoria is at A Contagious Smile Podcast, which is what you're listening to now.
Unnamed, right? Off of the platform of A Contagious Smile.
Yeah, I mean, but this is where they're listening to it.
Well, I don't care where they listen to it, as long as it helps them and they listen.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.